Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 166. I'm your host, Chris Webster, with my co-host, Paul Zimmerman. Today, we discuss an article that proposes archaeology as the next harbor for technology. Let's get to it. All right. Welcome to the show, everybody. Paul, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. I mean, for a good month or so, I was complaining about not having any work, and now I have too much work. So this has been a lot of fun. I've been flexing my archaeological muscles again. And I think I mentioned, but maybe I didn't, in a couple of days, I'm flying off to Iraq to go do some work in the site of Lagash. And I am thrilled.
Nice. I hope to get some awesome reports back from Iraq when you're done there. We'll definitely talk about it. Maybe even bring you on to the archaeology show. If listeners to this show aren't familiar with that, it's a show I do with my wife now, who's also an archaeologist. And we talk sites like that, right? No technical talk or anything like that. We just talk about the basics and things, and sometimes news articles and stuff like that. So it'd be awesome to get you on the archaeology show to talk about your experiences over there and the archaeology over there. And then maybe we'll have a debrief on the Archaeotech podcast about what you did over there and some of the other techie type things that you guys did.
Yeah, the techie kind of stuff that we're going to be doing there. My job is to be flying a drone. Oh, and that's new since last time. I took my Part 107 exam and passed it.
Nice.
So I'll be legal to fly drones, you know, for non-recreational purposes in the U.S. Well, I am already. I've got my temporary permit in hand, but I'll be doing that, you know, on this project in Iraq. I'm going to be making a new map of the site using photogrammetry, and we'll see, because there's been a bit of a mix up with the drone. We'll see which kind of drone I'm going to be using, but we've got that. And then the other archaeologist that's going out there is working on his dissertation, and he's looking at the extension of the land where the Tigris and the Euphrates join out and dump into the Persian Gulf, because that coastline has been extending over the millennia, you know, like in the same way that like the Mississippi River Delta has expanded, right? So he's looking at the soils there. So he's doing a number of cores. So we'll have some techie stuff to talk about.
There has got to be so much soil and material just dumped out by that river because of where it's at, you know, all the sand and everything that just moves easily with the river, man. I can imagine.
It's very flat, and those rivers constantly jump course anytime they flood, especially the Euphrates. And some of these major sites like Lagash, like Ur, which are now pretty far inland, back in antiquity when they were at their height, were, you know, Ur had a had docks on one side, had a harbor. So they were right there on the river, right next to the Persian Gulf, and now they're deep inland.
Wow, that's crazy. And I've been on the Persian Gulf in a nuclear aircraft carrier. And that's the only time. It's crazy, the intersection of things here. Yeah. All right. Well, we're not done talking about drones, because they're definitely going to be part of this next conversation. But we're going to talk about an article that was actually sent to us by the APN's co-founder, Tristan Boyle. He dropped it in our Slack channel here. And it's from Heritage Daily. I know, right? it's from Heritage Daily. We'll have the link in the show notes, but it's called Why Archaeology Will Be the Next Harbor for Technology. It was written on October 12th, 2021 by Terry Maddenholm. I think I'm saying that right. Terry Maddenholm. And she is a project partner for a company called Drone Archaeology. And they focus on identifying threatened archaeological sites using non-invasive technologies such as LIDAR, satellite imagery, and drones, and building 3D models of endangered heritage. And I will mention, we tried to get Terry on this, but I couldn't seem to get a hold of her through LinkedIn or through the Drone Archaeology website. So we'll keep trying, because I'd like to talk to the people that work for this company, because according to their website, man, they seem to have a really robust program across several continents and doing some really cool things, according to, like I said, the website, but I can't seem to get a hold of them. So that's what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, I was pretty excited looking at their website because one of their missions is education. Yeah. So they have a number of different courses and lectures available for archaeologists for a fee. They are a company.
Sure.
That's fine. I mean, if they're providing a good service, by all means, we should be able to pay for it in order to, you know, gain access to that knowledge. We don't all have to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah. So we're going to spend our time talking about some of the things that Terry mentions in this article, what we liked about it, what we didn't like about it, where we agree or disagree. And I'm sure this will be a good jumping off point for some other stuff that we are going to discuss. So the first thing that popped out at me in this article that I put in our notes is, and this is a quote from the article, is archaeologists are equipped with the newest technological tools that allow, and she goes on, but she mentions laser scanners, satellite imagery, .. And I'm just like, really? We spend our entire podcast talking about how archaeologists are kind of behind the times in most cases. So there's definitely forward-thinking archaeologists and companies out there that are trying to do, you know, better, not just established technologies. Like, it's odd to say that drones are an established technology now, but they really are. And even 3D printing is really, 3D printing and scanning really is kind of an established technology now that you can buy a rudimentary 3D printer for like $200. And those are now established things that more and more companies are starting to add to their routine versus their novelty lab items that they might use once or twice. When it gets added to the routine, that's when I would call it a big thing.
Yeah. I thought that satellite imagery was a bit of an odd one to put in there. In that I know archaeologists have been using, you know, Landsat 5 since the 70s. Tools to manipulate that satellite imagery have gotten better and faster and more accessible over the years. The accessibility of that image has gotten better along the way. But satellite imagery writ large is certainly nothing new in the field. I'm sure we've all used and experienced it in various ways. It's again, it's been getting better. And ever since, you know, Google Earth came out and we could start seeing, you know, detailed photographs of our site areas, our houses, our neighbors, all that stuff. It's gotten much, much easier to work with and interact with. And we can use as a test. I've seen a lot of different, you know, Google Earth base maps for things. But and that is satellite imagery. But I guess it's because of that ubiquity that I don't know that it had to be called out specifically.
Yeah, and you got to watch out for satellite imagery too, of course, right? Because if you're looking for the current state of affairs in a satellite image, obviously you're not going to necessarily get that depending on what you're actually working on. If you're working in somewhere at some place that's being developed, then there's little chance that the imagery you're going to get access to is actually current. Even the RV park we're in outside of Austin, Texas right now is not on the satellite images. They just opened in July, which means they were probably developing this, I would assume, through the early part of this year. But to be honest, I don't know when they started developing this, but it's a forest next to the highway if you look at the satellite. And now it's, you know, 100 RV spots and that are all paved and manicured. None of that's in the imagery.
I had something just now today on this project that I'm looking at, that I'm working on. I was looking at the map and we are following along where land surveyors, they're surveying in the course of a proposed hiking trail along the Hudson River. And so fortunately for us, we just go to the points that they've surveyed every 50 feet. And that's where we can drop our STPs, which is really easy. We don't even have to work with maps. But I was looking at the map that the principal sent me and looking at the course and following along what we did yesterday. And I'm like, it goes on the map. It goes to one side of a white dot. And I know what that white dot is. It's a structure. But when we were there, we were on the other side of the white dot. We were the other side of that structure. You know, it's just a shed right at the edge of the road. It's nothing big.
Yeah.
And I don't know, is that because the map was misaligned? Is that because the surveyors put the points in the wrong place? I hope not, but I'm not entirely sure what went wrong with that.
Jeez. Yeah, you never can tell, really. You just got to be careful with what you're looking at. One nice thing that Google Earth did, and Google Earth seems relatively unsupported now, the independent application. I think it's all basically rolled into Google Maps. But I just don't know well enough if this is a a thing you can easily find anymore. But again, one of the things Google Earth did really well was the historical imagery and telling you the year that the imagery you're looking at was actually collected and created. So that's pretty handy.
That's been something I use a lot, just idly because I'm not doing any research right now. But with Yemen, there's been so much construction in parts where I've worked that I can use it and I can see the expansion of towns. I can see the encroachment of fields upon sites. The land gets, you know, ripped up and changed. I see a couple historic forts that are no longer in existence. And you can see that because you can just use that little slider at the top of Google Earth and say, you know, this year, last year, 2 years ago, back as far as they have imagery for that particular location.
I used to like doing that for open pit mines in Nevada because the pit changes so dramatically.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Just looking back through the imagery and watching a mountain grow where where there isn't one now. So, all right. Well, let's take a short break and come back and continue talking about this article. In the meantime, go check it out. It's in the show notes, arcpodnet.com/archaeotech/166, or just take a look at whatever app you're using right now to listen to this podcast, unless you're driving, don't do that, and click on the article and it should take you straight there. Back in a minute. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code Archaeotech. That's ARCHAEOTECH.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 166. We're talking about an article from Heritage Daily written in October 2021. Check it out in the show notes. And I'm just kind of pulling out quotes here because let me just tell you, the article talks about a whole bunch of different technologies that the author says is transforming the field of archaeology. That is indisputable. All these things are actually transforming the field of archaeology in their own independent way. But she does it in a way that makes it seem like we're pioneering these things. And you know, maybe we're pioneering the use of LIDAR for archaeological research, sure, but we certainly didn't pioneer the use of LIDAR for anything, right? So, you know, and satellite imagery and AI and all this other stuff. Archaeology, I feel like the only thing we pioneered is camping in the wilderness, drinking heavily and working the next day without any problem. That's really like where it ends. So I think as far as being a pioneering sort of resource and saying that archaeology is almost the basis for these things and the place where these things are being allowed to be fruitful and develop more seems to be a little bit starry-eyed to me and not really following along the truth. I don't know. What do you think about that, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, the article is light on details. That's not its purpose. It's not trying to tell you. It's not trying to be an exhaustive list of things. It's a bit of a cheerleading for tech in archaeology. And that way, it's a lot like this here podcast, you know?
That's true.
It could well have been, you know, me just idly chatting about technology and archaeology off the top of my head. So it was, I wanted more. I think I say that about every article we read.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree with you. It did maybe give a bit of an aspirational sense of how technology is used in archaeology rather than make a forceful argument for how it can be used and what directions it can go. It was kind of like, hey, here's cool things. There might be other cool things coming down the road,
right?
Which is all true. Well, I can't fault her for that, but there wasn't enough meat really.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. So that leads right into one of the other quotes I pulled out, which is actually right near the beginning of the article, where she says that soon robotics and AI will become an essential part of the field, too. That much I don't dispute. Why not? Transforming archaeology into a discipline of the future. I feel like by the time robotics and AI become an essential part of the field, and using that word routine again, by the time they become routine, that archaeology will be just catching up with everyone else, not a discipline of the future. That seems, again, a little bit starry-eyed to me because, sure, we're already using robotics and AI in a way, right? You're talking about using something like drone deploy over in Iraq. That's literally robotics and AI doing the work for you. Like, you basically push a button after you program it, and the robot does all the work for you.
Mm-hmm. And then you upload all those images, and some other computer that I don't have to configure is going to stitch them all together and hopefully give me a good map at the end.
Exactly. Exactly. So we are already doing that. And I guess in the context of maybe some other businesses or industries, I should say, maybe we're a little bit part of the future. But man, I really feel like surveyors and a lot of other people have been doing a lot of this stuff, you know, well before the field of archaeology. I don't want to keep harping on that, like the starry-eyed nature of the article, because it is like a little bit of that throughout. That's the thrust of the whole thing, given the title. But you know, I just want to talk about these things independently, see where they're at today. But
I'm just going to put a little plug in here for something that I found out about last week, a book, and I'm plugging it because it's from the Santa Fe Institute, a few people that I follow on Twitter, and it's called Agent-Based Modeling for Archaeology, and they have a freely downloadable PDF of it. So I haven't had the chance to read it yet. Hopefully I'll be digging into it some on the really, really long flight from New York to Basra, but two flights actually, and a really, really long layover. But that maybe kind of unpack for me a little bit about what we might mean by using AI in archaeology. So I'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes too.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds good. Yeah. Let's talk about a few more things here. She says that we may expect in the coming years a launch of a satellite specially designed for archaeological use. And again, I thought that was a cool thing to say, but man, that is pure speculation on her part. And I'm wondering, who would fund that? It's always a question of who's going to pay for that. And if you could launch a satellite specifically for archaeological use, what kind of attributes would that have? And then more importantly, how would you control tasking? Like who gets to use it? But let's say, what would you want it to do if we had our own satellite for archaeological use?
Probably the biggest thing I would want to do would be able to monitor sites remotely and automated by itself. We could probably do that with existing satellite imagery and the existing tool sets, but that would probably be the highest priority for me, especially because so many of the parts of the world I've worked are really subject to bad looting. But it could not just be looting. It can also be, like I said before, encroachment of cities and farmers' fields, construction activities like roads and so on, basically to fill in some of the gaps to maybe predict areas of high sensitivity before we actually have to send people on the ground to go look at. That to me would be something specifically archaeological that we could do. It wouldn't be groundbreakingly new in terms of the technologies applied, but it would be, if there was a purpose-built satellite system for doing that, that would be useful, I could see. Do you have any ideas? Because, one of the things that we get at the same time criticized for and lionized for as archaeologists is that we don't really invent our own stuff, and radiocarbon is often held up as the only thing that was ever really invented by and for archaeologists. And I don't even know how much the "by" was by archaeologists. I everything I can think of, I struggle to come up with something new that wouldn't be already in use by agriculture, for example, forestry, things that are much more lucrative industries, and then we could piggyback off of their technologies.
Yeah, and you're totally right. I mean, there's so many things that we just use, that's one of the things I do like about archaeology, though, is we are a multifaceted discipline that does use a number of other things in order to answer a single question, right? Like, what, why, and how, you know, how'd they get here? What were they doing? And, you know, how'd they do it? So that's not a single question. It kind of is. It's your thesis for the whole site, but yeah. And that's what I, that's, again, that's what I really like about it. But I think some things I would like, go to back to the satellite question, is obviously the highest resolution you could possibly get, because I'd love to be able to do some pattern shape recognition and analysis based off of satellite imagery and do some preliminary survey type of thing with that, and using some algorithms and machine learning type stuff to figure out what's there before you even go out there. That would be super cool. But then the other types of imagery that you could probably do off of a satellite as well, right? Not just visual imagery, but, you know, some sort of multispectral imagery or something that would help us see other things. You can't do like, you can't do LIDAR off a satellite. I don't think that that wouldn't work, but it needs too much power. But there's got to be other stuff. There's other types of satellite imagery that would definitely benefit archaeology. Maybe some that don't even exist yet.
Right. But benefit archaeology is different than something being purposely built for archaeology.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess. And, yeah. Yeah. I guess.
I mean, I guess we're splitting hairs here, but but that did stick out to me as well. Reading, I was like, really? Something for archaeologists? I have troubles believing that.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed.
I mean, unless it's a new microbrew, I can't imagine anything for archaeologists.
Trust me, there have been plenty of those made just for archaeologists, plenty of archaeology brewers out there.
Guilty.
I guess when I was thinking of the satellite, I wasn't even thinking of something made with new technologies invented for archaeology. I was just thinking of a satellite, literally a satellite put together with existing technologies, but tasked only for archaeology. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, that's basically what I was arguing with the monitoring satellite. New technologies require somebody smarter than I am, more inventive than I am, more able to think outside the box and integrate different kinds of scientific techniques that I'm capable of. But existing ones, that's, you know, I can think of them, but I also can't imagine where the like you said, the money would be, the pull, the real interest. And that's why I went to that's why I went to monitoring, because, you know, what we saw with ISIS in Syria in particular is that there is worldwide interest in what happens to archaeological sites when they get damaged or destroyed. But is that enough to translate into real action, or is it, you know, yet another one-third scale model of the arch at Palmyra?
Right, right. Yeah. And when I try to think of new stuff as well, I mean, invention is driven by need, right? And archaeologists have a pretty common need, aside from the typical archaeological questions that we try to answer, we have a pretty common need of collecting and organizing large amounts of data, making sure everything is accessible in multiple formats. Like you said, you know, the destruction of certain things. I mean, even Notre Dame as well, when that burned down, if we didn't have so many scans of that, I mean, they were able to basically, I saw a 3D model that was put together of Notre Dame from Instagram images, because so many people have stood in front of it and taken pictures of it. They were able to get enough photos to basically reconstruct it. And it's been scanned so many times on the inside and out for video games and other things that, if they want to build that thing exactly as it was before it burned down, it will be absolutely no problem. We know every square inch of that thing, almost literally every square inch. And so having that kind of data is something that we need. But really, our needs come down to who's going to pay for it and who's going to do it, because I feel like the technologies already exist to do a lot of the things we want to do. We just don't have the funds or time or research case in some instances to actually get it done, like virtually reconstructing, let's say, the entire planet at different time periods, right? That would be super cool. We're already gathering the data to do that in most cases. It would be fun to put something like that together, but who could possibly do that? You know, who could possibly do that? Lithodomos VR, maybe? I don't know. So, yeah. Anyway, let's take our final break and wrap this article up on the other side. And I want to talk about our tiny robot army that we're going to deploy. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Back in a second.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs, so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the final segment of episode 166 of the Archaeotech Podcast. And we're talking about this article in Heritage Daily, linked in the show notes. One of the last quotes I wrote down here that Terry mentions in the article is, "We can therefore envision that in the near future, archaeologists will deploy legions of tiny bots that will perform archaeological operations while documenting each step of the process. They would be used to collect samples, for example, DNA testing, without disturbing the integrity of the site." And I got to tell you, that is really, really crazy to me. Awesome. Don't get me wrong. I can think of many cases where I've seen an episode of Star Trek that mentioned something about nanobots. And I'm like, wow, we could really use that to do some stuff. Because if you can imagine actual nanobots, right? Not just tiny robots doing things. Because we actually talked about that snake-like tube robot thing that can move through sites and have a camera. So that's one thing. But I'm thinking like nanobots that can actually go through the soil, not disturb the soil necessarily, but go through the soil like tiny little sugar ants. And then everything they touch kind of gets mapped and you get this full profile under the ground. And then they come back out, go back into their tube. Hopefully they don't, take over the planet and do whatever, get absorbed into your body, whatever the case may be. But just do that sort of thing. I could envision that. But seriously, where is that technology and when is that technology?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly don't have anything small enough like that, autonomous enough like that, and that could map at details like that. But I thought that was kind of interesting because, I've joked with you about your tricorder that you pull out and you get a snapshot of what's under the ground right there. And you know, how many levels and how deep and where's the architecture and where are the fire pits and blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
That would actually be one way about actually making that happen. So not through a magic scanner, but through little physical devices that go and do the digging with as minimal disturbance as possible and do the recording as accurately and as comprehensively as possible, and then return with all that information. And you deploy, I don't know, hundreds or thousands across a site, let them do that, and then collect, and now you've got a snapshot. So that might work, but again, when would anything like that be coming down the pike? I can't imagine it's anywhere within the next 20 years. And I mean, yes, lack of imagination is not a good basis for an argument, but I really can't imagine it coming around too soon.
Well, and are you saying 20 years before something like that is invented or 20 years before archaeologists would get their hands on it? Because it's got to be at least 10 years after it's invented that we'd be able to afford it.
I was thinking 20 years until it's invented. And I don't think that the gap is necessarily that long. I mean, how long did it take for drones, since we mention them all the time, to go from being, something that only the military had to something that was a really kind of cool toy to something that is pretty commonly used by many, many different projects? I mean, probably about 15 years, right?
Yeah, I suppose so. Because the first... Well, it's a real interesting question, right? Like drones fascinate me because I grew up with RC airplanes, right? And not RC helicopters, but I definitely seen them. We never had any RC helicopters, but my dad was an RC modeler and my grandfather was. And I just grew up from the time I was an infant to being around RC airplanes. My dad still flies and builds RC airplanes. And so I've been around that for a long time. And how... It's like when somebody first threw a camera on something and made it so pretty much anybody could fly it because it had four rotors that would maintain stability. All of a sudden, they're called drones. Like, why aren't RC airplanes called drones? You know, when did that technology really start and then become and then modify itself and evolve into the thing you can buy in the gas station today and take pictures of your neighbor with over the fence? Because even the small ones that you can buy for $25 have a camera inside them in most cases. So I feel like it's that camera technology and the transmission of that camera data back to like a smartphone. So also smartphone technology that actually brought this into play for more than just your hobbyist that wants to fly something around. So along those lines, you're right. When they became small enough and more affordable for archaeologists to use, it was still a few years before they did it, because archaeologists aren't really, you know, again, you need somebody that's not only tech forward in their thinking, but also not scared to learn how to fly something, which is a completely different skill than most people even think they have. You know, it's not that hard, but it's also one of those things that people are just afraid of. Even if they are tech forward, they're going to back away from that because they're afraid of flying, you know, or afraid of, you know, that RC aspect of it. So I don't know. I didn't answer your question. I just asked 10 more, but there you go.
I think that the camera has a lot to do with it, actually.
Yeah.
The camera and, like you said, the stability of having the quad rotor, which is what we generally think of when we think of drones. Though from the FAA's perspective, you know, you can have a fixed wing drone.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, absolutely. SUAS, they fall under the same regulations. You have to fly them differently, but you're under the exact same regulations and under the exact same permit to do so.
Mm-hmm.
But that camera bit, I think, is really what made the difference.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Because all our imagery of like drones from the Iraq War or everything, it's always somebody sitting in a room, you know, hundreds or a thousand miles away, piloting a thing remotely, and you see the grainy video of, you know, people on the ground being shot at. I think that kind of that expectation of how you interact with the machine through that camera, that vision of the camera that it's carrying on board itself, is really kind of what tipped people's perception of these things over from being you know, the RC airplanes, like what you and I know from our youths, to these drones that are everywhere. And they suddenly became very, very useful for archaeologists. But I don't think that, but back to my other point, though, I think that like the adoption of so many technologies is happening quicker and quicker. I think that the passing from cutting edge to standard toolkit for archaeologists is, you know, going that same transformation. Things are moving along faster and faster, more pace.
Yeah, I think they are.
I did want to make a little comment, though, because the example with the legions of tiny robots was collecting samples for DNA testing, for example, which I thought, you're sending them down specifically at burials or what? But the DNA testing, even though it kind of only really gets this kind of passing mention in this article, is one of those areas that the technology and archaeology, you know, so from medical sciences, from biological sciences, from chemical sciences, from physics, these things have been coming back into archaeology in some interesting ways. So, you know, I've mentioned before that I'm on the board of the New York Society, the AIA, and we had a lecture last week by Dr. Felix Stockhammer from the Max Planck Institute, talking about different, what was the term? It was bioarchaeological techniques being applied to Mycenaean and Minoan sites. And so he was talking, it was just a broad overview, but with details on each of them. So it was a lot to chew on. We recorded it, but it's a lot of unpublished work. So we're not going to be able to put it up on a YouTube channel until sometime in 2022 when it does get published. But I got a lot of great feedback from people afterwards about it because they were so excited by the ways that he was illustrating. So just as a couple examples, he was talking about lipid analyses from dental tartar to find out about, you know, what people were eating, right? You know, that's definitely something that you wouldn't have been able to do probably 10 years ago, but they were doing that. And so they were finding all sorts of things about like the kinds of foods that distinct populations were eating because they have a lot of burials. They also did DNA. This is where I was tying it back to that DNA comment, they also did DNA analyses of a bunch of different, showing different marital patterns, because they could trace out the cladograms of, you know, relatedness of people through their DNA and say that, you know, this society seems to have had a high preference for cousin marriage, for first cousin marriage.
Yeah.
And in the Q&A at the end, a classicist that I know came on all excited. He's like, oh, that might explain the housing on these sites that we're at, because they look like palaces in terms of the size that that these buildings are, but they're not divided up in the same way the palaces are. It's like an agglomeration of distinct houses, you know, like nuclear family houses. Like, these might be kinship groups related through this first cousin marriage and their descendants. So that went, you know, from archaeology, getting the excavating the burials, through the scientists doing the DNA analyses, back into the archaeology, and then that fed back into another archaeological question, possibly an answer to an existing archaeological question. So that was really cool to see, and that's the kind of stuff that I think I wish I had more ability to discuss. Because, you know, you and I talk a lot about satellite imagery and drones because we're both, you know, at some level aerospace geeks and like looking at the world top down. But there are all sorts of great questions that can be asked by people that that are coming at it from other hard science techniques. But of course, it's like we've said a million times, it's getting, you know, that biologist, that chemist, talking to that archaeologist and speaking enough of the same language that they can come up with new techniques, new questions to ask, and possibly, like in this case, some new answers.
Yeah, and that is one of the great things about an article like this, that people may be exposed to Heritage Daily. This may have been shared because it has archaeology in it. Maybe you've got a news alert or something like that. And an article like this that mentions, you know, 10 different things, maybe you knew about the top three or four that that a bunch of people know about, like drones and 3D printing and things like that. But maybe there were some things in here that you hadn't even considered. And now you can think about how those technologies that are new to you can be applied to your site. So along the same lines of what you're talking about, I mean, keeping an open mind in the types of things you read, listen to, and search for, and go to lectures on and stuff like that will just help you become, I think, a better scientist, really, like any scientific profession, just broadening your horizons on what's possible and thinking, well, what can that do for me in archaeology? Can I do anything with that? You know, aside from just saying, I have a question I can't answer, I don't know how to answer it, what field could do that? I find it's easier to look at different and newer fields and say, how can I apply that to what I'm doing now? You know, because it's hard to imagine things that you don't know exist, but it's easy to take something you know exists and say, how can I apply that to what I'm doing? So I don't know. When we were having the nanobot discussion, I typed in nanorobotics into Google, and I didn't obviously read the whole thing because we're podcasting right now, but I'll maybe link to this. I don't know. I might not, because just Google nanorobotics, there's a whole bunch of things that come out, but there's just one brief thing I saw in this Science Daily article talking about metallic nanotechnology. It's an area that allows microscopic particles of metals such as gold and silver to be manipulated with heat and light. So they're really talking about this from a medical standpoint. So moving these metallic articles around, they're not robots, right? Like, you're using, I don't know what they look like, if they're just, you know, several atoms of gold or something like that. It is nano, so it's you know, 0.1, what is that, 0.1 0.01 meters or millimeters or something like that. I can't remember what the actual nano is, but it's really small particles of stuff being manipulated by an outside force. And that's super cool. That's a way that I hadn't even thought about doing what I was mentioning with, you know, releasing something into the soil that you can then extract back out. But can you control it? And then can you get feedback on position and location of that thing? That's basically how stuff like GPR works, right? Or resistivity. Mm-hmm. It's basically sending out a signal and recording what comes back based on what it hit as an obstruction. Well, you could do the same thing with particles of something or little tiny robots and just send them out if you can record their positions, or they can report back their positions when they get back and what they encountered. You can map what's under the surface. They just can't be too small, because, you know, if you find pottery, they can't go through the pottery. They have to stop at the pottery wall so it can map the pottery.
Well, if they're really, really small, they could go through the pottery.
That's what I'm talking about. You have to figure out what the right size is, right? So if you've got like a clay soil with pottery in it, you might kind of be screwed because the pottery is going to be way more porous than that clay soil. Like what kind of robot would you even throw into there that could not go through the pottery? How does it know to stop at the pottery and not just think, yay, it's a much more easy surface to get through than this clay, you know? So
somebody needs to make a new t-shirt of that little archaeological nanobot going, yay.
Yay. Nice. Nice. All right. Well, check out the show notes. We've got a few things in there, including this article. I'd like to hear your thoughts on it and see what you guys think about it. And you know, what have you seen on TV, radio, news, podcasts, magazines, you know, Google searches that you thought this is a cool thing? How could I use this for technology? And if you've come up with something, I'd like to hear about it. And if you haven't come up with something, let us know. Maybe Paul and I can come up with a reason, a way to do it. That's one, man, that would be a fun episode, wouldn't it? Where we just Google these like wacky technologies, like this metallic nano robotics, and say, okay, how would I use that for archaeology? Let's just force it into this archaeology bucket and see what we could do with it. That would be super fun. So, all right. Any other thoughts on this, Paul?
Probably, but at the moment I think I'm tapped out.
All right. Sounds good. Well, I hope to next time it's just going to be me because Paul's going to be in Iraq. And we had an interview scheduled actually for this one that failed for technological reasons. So we're doing this instead. So we'll probably have a pretty good GIS and CRM discussion on the next episode. And I'm not going to put too many details out because if we don't do it, we don't do it. So we'll find out. But stay tuned for that. I think it's going to be okay. I think we're going to get to do that one. And Paul will be looking forward to in a few episodes from now when you get back and talk about Iraq and how your experience was over there.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks, everybody. And we'll see you next time.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the ArchaeoTech Podcast. Links to items mentioned on the show are in the show notes at www.archpodnet.com/ArchaeoTech. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and paul@lugal.com. Support the show by becoming a member at archpodnet.com/members. The music is a song called Off Road and is license free from Apple. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.